House Judiciary Committee for February the 1st, 2007. We've got five bills set for public hearing and possible work session, and I intend to take them in the numerical order they appear on your agenda. So we'll start by opening a hearing on House Bill 2318. Council Plummer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2318 makes the time period for settlement 60 days from the end of mediation before the appeal is assigned to a tax magistrate. The time period is currently 60 days from the time the case is assigned to mediation. It also authorizes parties to make a good showing of cause for continuance. This act would apply to matters assigned to mediation on or after the effective date of this act.
Okay, we have Jill Tanner from the Oregon Tax Court signed up. Ms. Tanner?
Good morning, and members of the committee. Thank you very much. My name is Jill Tanner. I'm currently the presiding magistrate of the Oregon Tax Court, and I'm here on behalf of the judge of the Oregon Tax Court, Henry Breithoff, who sends his regrets. He's currently in Multnomah County handling motions for the day. So he can't be here, but would like to have been if it had worked out scheduling, but that didn't happen. If you'd like to know a little bit about the bill, it's really, from our perspective, it's a response to those that use our program. In the tax court, the mediation program is voluntary. And the parties feel that the time, the way that the statute is currently written, is not enough time for the whole process to occur in a very short period of time once they are notified that the magistrate has been assigned to mediate the case. They're only going to have 60 days from that date to meet with the magistrate, get their information together, set a mediation date, have the mediation, and then determine the outcome. They have said that they feel that that period of time is just too short. They want to continue to work. It's all voluntary. They want to make sure they have adequate time to be able to review the issues, make sure the magistrate understands the issues as the mediator, and an opportunity to settle the matter. So this is a response to their request.
Thank you, Ms. Tanner. Is the mediation always initiated at the request of the taxpayer?
In our court, 99% of the time, yes.
Okay, so in effect, the way the law works now is that the taxpayer has the right to bring a mediator in, and then it's the taxpayer and somebody from the Department of Revenue, I assume, who's handling the collection.
Oftentimes, or it could be a county that's property
or a
tax
county.
Matter.
Okay, and but anyway, whatever taxing agency is pursuing the taxes that they think are owed, mm-hmm. come in together with a mediator. And who are the mediators?
The magistrates in our division. We're all we've all been trained, and each of the magistrates is able to and does do the program of mediation.
And under current law, there's a 60-day period to accomplish all of that, and if not accomplished within the 60 days, then it gets set for a hearing, not a mediation, but a hearing before the magistrate in which a decision is made on the appeal.
Yes, right. It's a okay. trial. And it's not the same individual who does the mediation will not do the trial,
right.
obviously,
right.
for obvious reasons.
Okay. Committee, are there any other questions for Ms. Tanner? Okay. Thank you. We have a... actually, why don't you stay there, because we have another witness, somebody from the Department of Revenue is going to come up, and so in case that generates any questions, why don't you both be available to us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is John Phillips. I'm with the Oregon Department of Revenue.
Do you need another one?
And we're just here to say that I've had a chance to talk with Presiding Magistrate Tanner, and we're in support of the notion that placing an arbitrary date on a mediation does not make a lot of sense. But we have one concern, and that is about mediations that potentially would go on indefinitely. And we chatted about that before the hearing, and we're going to look into the rules to see if there's anything that would allow the magistrate or either party just to make sure that there's some provision that would allow one party or the other to ask for a termination of the proceedings. The overriding concern is that for every month that the proceeding continues, a tax refund that goes to the local taxing districts carries with it 12% interest, so it gets to be kind of an expensive proposition if it's delayed. So I think this can be resolved. Like as I said, I chatted with Presiding Magistrate Tanner, and she believes there's already a provision for that, and so I'd like to continue that discussion if possible.
Okay, Mr. Phillips, the 12% interest, that catches my attention because that's an above-market rate of interest, as it's not unusual in tax liabilities. So that's the liability that's running on the taxpayer's obligation? Or it sounded like maybe that was something that was owed from one agency of government to another.
Mr. Chair, in the property tax system, there's two kinds of interest. There's delinquent interest when you fail to pay your taxes on time, and there's refund interest when you are owed taxes that you have overpaid. The refund interest is 12%, or 1% per month, and the delinquent interest, if you fail to pay your taxes on time, is 16%. So there have been discussions over the years about bringing the refund interest down, and there are discussions also at that same time about bringing the delinquent interest down, but nothing has been done over the years about that. So,
any questions, committee, for either of these witnesses? Well, then it sounds like there's something that needs to be confirmed before the bill would be in shape to move, and that it may be that it's in shape now. Once you've confirmed that it wouldn't be an indefinite extension for mediation, but that you need time to confirm that. Is that my understanding the situation correctly?
And Mr. Chair, I don't intend to slow the bill down at all, and I think if we have a chance to chat, if it's rescheduled, I think we'll be fine.
Very good. Okay, if there are no other questions, then I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2318. We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2319. Council Plummer.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2319 requires the Department of Revenue to notify the County Treasurer of high-value appeals.
And we have Ms. Tanner. Please tell us more about this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Jill Tanner, and I'm the presiding magistrate of the Oregon Tax Court, again, here on behalf of Judge Henry Breitoff. This bill is a very important bill because it has, or I should say the statute is a very important statute, because it places a reporting requirement currently on the court, but previously, up until 1995, this reporting responsibility was on the Department of Revenue. When in 1995, the question should be, well, why would it change and move to this responsibility, move to the Oregon Tax Court, when in fact all the information is maintained by the Oregon Department of Revenue? And it really was one of those kinds of things that happens during a legislative session when there's lots of activity going on, and the Oregon Tax Court was taking on the responsibility of appeals, first-level appeals, that the Department of Revenue previously had been assigned and asked to handle. So as a result, when the legislation was being changed and people were cleaning up the law, every time they saw the word Oregon Department of Revenue in conjunction with the word appeal, they replaced it with Oregon Tax Court. And in most cases, that was fine. That worked really well. We have been now we're almost in our 10th year of operation as the Magistrate Division of the Tax Court. And we find that every time we have to make this report, we have to go over to the Oregon Department of Revenue and get the information. They have to provide it to us, and then we have to notify the counties. This legislation does not change the reporting requirement. It is a very important piece of information that the counties need to be aware of, that there are large appeals in their counties of the values that they have previously determined. What we would like to do is be able to put the responsibility back to the Department of Revenue, where all the information is, where they maintain it, and where they can continue to do the program as they had done it before in 1995 and prior. And again, Mr. Phillips, of course, is here. I've had discussions with the director of the Department of Revenue, and there is absolutely, as far as I know, no opposition at all since they have the information. They have done the done the reporting before, and they're willing to take that responsibility.
Okay. Any questions for Ms. Tanner? Okay, that seems pretty straightforward then. I will close the public public hearing on House Bill 2319 and open a work session on House Bill 2319. And I agree with what I was hearing from one of my colleagues here that this would be suitable for the consent calendar. If it's our pleasure to move it. Is there a motion?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2319 out with a new pass to the consent calendar.
Representative Barker moves House Bill 2319 to the floor with a due pass recommendation to be placed on the consent calendar. Any discussion? Hearing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Bonamici?
Aye.
Representative
Kelly? Aye.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative Kong?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Reed?
Aye.
Vice Chair Barker?
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisden?
Aye.
Chairman Perkins?
Aye. House Bill 2319 is moved to the floor due pass with replacing the consent calendar. I'll close the work session on House Bill 2319 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2320.
Thank you all very much for your time.
Yeah, thank you, Ms. Tanner. Council Plummer.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2320 authorizes the State Court Administrator to enter into governmental agreements with the United States Financial Management Service and the Internal Revenue Service for the purpose of offsetting federal tax refunds of debtors against their liquidated and delinquent accounts owing to state courts or owing to commissions, departments, or divisions in the judicial branch. The bill also requires the Oregon Lottery Commission to notify the state court administrator when a lottery winner whose prize exceeds $600 is delinquent in paying liquidated accounts owing to state courts or other divisions of the state judicial branch.
Okay, we have two witnesses signed up, Kingsley Click from the Judicial Department and Dale Penn from the lottery. And would it make sense for Mr. Penn for you to come forward at the same time so we could engage you in questions at the same time?
Good morning.
Ms. Click.
For the record, I'm Kingsley Click, the State Court Administrator. This bill was pre-session filed at the request of the Judicial Department. Its purpose is twofold, but the primary purpose is to enhance our collections program with a couple of tools that seem particularly effective. The first one is to provide state legislation that allows us to enter into an agreement with the federal government to have tax offsets against federal tax refunds in the same way that we now have the authority to go after debt against state tax refunds with the State Department of Revenue. There is a federal legislation that is required in 2005 and 2006. This was going through the U.S. Congress. Senator Gordon Smith was helping shepherd it through. It was caught up in some tax legislation that did not pass in last November with elections and then the rush to adjournment. Showing a bipartisan support is to be reintroduced this spring with Gordon Smith and Representative Schuman from New York, who's a Democrat. We've not heard that there is any opposition to it. It's just usually part of a larger bill that has issues. The National Center for State Courts has been looking at this on a national basis, so it's trying for all state courts to have a way to use the federal tax refund offsets. So we've just been some of the at the forefront of it. So we do need the federal legislation to pass. It's already there and allows it for child support. Court debt is the next largest area that they're looking to expand it to. We need a companion piece in our state law once the federal legislation passes to allow us to enter into these agreements. If the federal law gets hung up and doesn't pass right away and we pass this, there isn't a problem because we still, it's enabling legislation and we can't do anything until the other piece is there, so it doesn't harm it if it passes here ahead of time. So that is that piece. We do from our analysis that over the last 3 years, the estimate is there would be approximately $58 million current uncollected debt obligations, a biennium, that we would be able to collect if we could access the federal tax refunds coming back. And we provided that analysis to the Legislative Fiscal Office. The other piece of the bill is involves the State Lottery Commission, and right now, they're under state law, they check lottery winners for delinquent child support obligations. Similarly, this would allow them the authority in this 30-day window that they now can hold up proceeds for child support obligations, would allow us to have the same benefit. We would need to enter into an intergovernmental agreement with lottery. We would need to provide costs for any reprogramming and the staffing time to look at it because they cannot, under the Constitution, use their revenue for these other purposes. The estimates for that are less than $50,000 to do that one-time setup programming costs, and then probably, as I understand, around $20,000 to do the staffing issues. But based on our review, we tested it this last year, looking at who's won over $600 and who has outstanding debt under our system. And looking at those reviews, the estimate is that $300,000 to $400,000 a biennium could be collected through this method. The bill right now has a kind of presumption priority and says child support A and the courts B. Under federal law, child support is always the first priority for the for the money obligations. The lottery has some interest in us clarifying that, and we have no objection if we need to make that part of this statute more clearly. The other method we could do it is through our intergovernmental agreement with them. We could say the understanding is your obligation is first child support and second court debt. So.
And Ms. Kleck, do you think that needs to be clarified about with an amendment to this bill in order to satisfy the requirements under the federal legislation?
Chair McPherson, we were just having that discussion. In my reading, the federal law issue would trump it, but the question is, does it make it less complicated for anyone referring to the statute to have it expressly provided? And that's where we left the conversation.
Okay.
Mr. Penn may have an opinion.
We may want to revisit that, but let's skip to sort of the more general background. If there are no questions for Representative
Cameron. Thank you, Mr. Chair. On the estimate, how did you arrive at that $300,000 to $400,000 estimate?
Yes. Mr. Chair, Representative Cameron, I would ask Cheryl Stone, our collections manager, to come up, please, because she did conduct that review. But my understanding is we went through the last 6 months' worth of winnings and compared them. But, Ms. Cheryl, do you identify yourself for the record?
For the record, I'm Cheryl Stone from the Oregon Judicial Department. Chair McPherson, Representative Cameron, we did take the last 6 months. We reviewed a winnings report provided by Lottery, looked them up in the OJD database, OGEN, and to determine if they owed money. And we determined, based upon winnings that were given to individuals and debt that they had with the courts, how much we might be able to offset in the future if we had legislation. So we took that and averaged it out over a biennium.
A follow-up with me? Do we know how many individuals that was and what the average debt was to arrive at this?
We do have that information, and we could provide that. Chair McPherson and Representative.
I'd like to see that. Thank you.
Representative Wisnett.
Chairman. Where did we come up with the $600? I mean, why not 500? Why not 400? What was the rationale? Is there reporting or computer system that made 600 easier to track?
Chair McPherson, Representative Wisnett, the $600, over $600, people are required to go into the lottery office for their winnings. Under $600, they are paid out from the retailer. And so just the requirement of going into the lottery office and working with a central source to be able to offset.
Follow up. Thank you. I understand that. But, I mean, so one benefit we get out of this, besides helping the education and the other things that use the lottery funds, but if we went to 500, would we be able to, you know, collect another 100,000 for children or families and support?
Chair McPherson, Representative Wisnett, I would not have those numbers. I don't know how many more prize winners would come through the lottery office if the threshold was lowered to 500.
Well, unless there are pressing questions, why don't we hear from Director Penn at this point, because he can give the lottery agency perspective, and then maybe we can come back to those questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Dale Penn. I'm Director of the Oregon Lottery. I'm not here to speak on the policy of the bill. I just was here to talk about implementation issues. We believe that, as Kingsley Click has testified, that we'd be able to resolve issues about implementation, the restriction on the use of our dollars through an intergovernmental agreement, the cost that you've heard, less than $50,000 for this biennium for setup and operation. In future bienniums, I believe it would be around $20,000 or less for staff time. So I think there are some benefits to the state. We would have to maintain a separate accounting system because people would say, well, why is it that we have any staff time? But we are going to have to separately account for these dollars because constitutionally our dollars can only be spent in certain ways. So, the other two points I would make is I would encourage the committee not to expand this bill. I think it's appropriate for judicial to be considered to be added to what has taken place 10 or 12 years ago with child support payments because both of them involve court orders. And however, there are many debts owed to state government, from administrative fines to all types of processes. And the legality and the collection process for those fines are different. And appellate rights and all of those legal analysis of those debts create some complicated issues for us. The other issue that I will say and why I would hope that the legislature would not consider expanding this at this time, allow this to go forward, let's monitor what happens the next 2 years, is that we are a sales organization, and that's what our focus is. And whenever we change the experience of the buyer and the winner, I don't know what impact we're going to have on sales. Certainly, we expect to have some negative impact when we tell a person who's very excited about winning $1,000 that that's great. And by the way, since you have that speeding ticket, we'll be taking $600 for that and this other ticket. So thanks for paying your bills, but we have no money to give you. So we're trying to make preparation for how that will be received, but we think it's appropriate for us to do that. Right now, child support obligations, we collect about once a month. However, the numbers that we see on this, we expect it to be once a day kind of experience. And that's why I think we're believing it'd be 15 to 20 people a month. And so about once a day, and then that's how this was arrived at. So I am concerned about what that experience will be and will it have some impact on sales, only because last week I was here at Ways and Means, and if some of you were there or revenue committees, talking about the fact that our traditional sales are flat certainly we've been able to increase our revenues for state government, but our ticket sales, our megabucks, all of our products except Powerball as a traditional product, which this would primarily apply to, they are flat. And so I have to be careful about what negative pressures there will be on our sales. But I believe it's appropriate to move forward. I just ask that you not expand it at this time. The last thing I would say is that we would appreciate having an amendment, and I would suggest line 34 on page 2 of the bill, where you simply just say collection priority will be provided to and make your choice. Obviously, federal law enters into play, and it's not my position to give you what that priority should be. I had thought that in my legal career, I've collected child support all those 28 years, but then I thought, well, I've also collected court fines all of those years, so I guess I've worked in both of those. But we would appreciate that because our staff who will be interacting with that individual, they may have their own opinions. I want you to take it out of this. And if we don't have clear direction, it's a lot easier for a person to say, look, state law says the child support comes first or the court fine comes first. So that would be helpful to us. I'll delve into the question that was asked about why $600. This was something, and I certainly wasn't director of a lottery when this was debated, but I know it was worked on extensively and has been reviewed a couple of times by the legislature. We require withholding at $600. And so that is a very problematic issue to go out to all of our retailers, over 3,000 retailers and a Plaid Pantry and others, and say you will fill out tax withholding forms whenever you pay this amount. We receive a tremendous benefit from our retailers for paying our prizes below the $600. If we require every person to come to Salem for less than $600, it becomes very problematic. You're in Burns. You're in Joseph, Oregon. You're in different locations, and certainly when you're getting a large amount, people make efforts, and we just gave a megabucks winner yesterday from Grants Pass. They were happy to drive up I-5 to get their couple of million dollars. But the increased paperwork and pressure on our retailers and on our winners, that is the reason it was drawn at $600, because that is the level for mandatory withholding. So that's how we got there.
Any questions from the committee? Ms. Clegg.
Excuse me for a moment, Chair McPherson. Just to follow up on Dale's statement, it is a policy decision for this body to weigh on that. And if 600 is a threshold that seems to interfere with your other needs, it could be a higher threshold if you go with the overall concept. The one thing I just wanted to add to Mr. Penn's remarks, he talked about traffic fines. 91% of our unpaid debt, this delinquent debt, is related to felony and misdemeanor cases, and 30% of that is related to restitution to victims and compensatory fines. So at whatever threshold or whatever you're looking at, I just wanted to notice you that for the most part what we're talking about is a different type of delinquent debt. That's very hard to collect.
Mr. Chair, if I could just say one thing. I don't want my comments to be interpreted that in any way I'm opposing this policy. That isn't the reason I'm here. And I would not encourage you to increase the $600 limit. I was just trying to give you, let's not go below that. It gets very complicated. But
Ms. Cook, could you just run those numbers by me again? I didn't absorb them. So the amounts that are covered by this bill, that the judicial department would be able to then collect through this mechanism, they're criminal and civil judgments and restitution judgments, which I guess are a form of criminal judgment, that are entered by the judicial branch. Is that correct?
Chair McPherson, yes, I the numbers I mentioned were out of the liquidated debt report. That 91% of our unpaid balances relate to felony and misdemeanor. Approximately 54% are felony. Approximately 37 are related to misdemeanor. Of balances owed, that 30% of these delinquent debt are related to restitution and compensatory fines. That's approximately $162 million.
How many million?
$162.5 million.
Ms. Click, there was a little flurry of publicity given about 6 or 8 months ago to the unpaid status of drunk driving fines in particular, and those were sort of singled out as and there were press accounts about how many millions of dollars had gone unpaid from people who owed them for drunk driving. And I assume that's one subset of this number, right?
Chair McPherson, yes.
I see. Okay. And if I remember the discussions around at the time, although it was focused on but in the press accounts, it's just a dimension of a larger problem, which is that it's hard to collect these obligations from people who owe them.
Chair McPherson, correct. It's a different clientele.
Representative Barker?
Just briefly, so I know I owe an obligation. I win $1,000, so I tell my wife, go down and cash it in for me. So that's the way around that?
Mr. Chair and Representative Barker, I wasn't going to throw that out there, but people make adjustments. These are bearer instruments,
yeah.
And whoever walks in the door with the instrument, unless we have specific information and it's stolen, we're obligated under the law to pay that individual. I have heard rumors of that type of thing for child support. People have to trust, though, that they're going to pay them the money. But that will be a complicator, and that's something, though, for us to watch. But I think there's good reason to believe that those figures that judicial branch tells you, at least initially, should be there, and we'll have to see if that would decrease over the years.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Any further questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Penn, you recommended something to set out the priorities because I can understand the rationale for that it's better for your staff. Is that something that needs to be done in the statute or can be done by rule?
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Bonacci, forgive me, please. My first time in front of this committee. We would prefer to have it in statute because, again, I'm thinking about the person at a counter talking to this individual. They're upset. They want it paid a certain way. And we can say, well, we have an agreement with the judicial branch to do it this way. It's much easier for the staff to be able to say state law says this is what we'll do. That's the reason I would request that.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Not hearing any, then my inclination would be for us not to work this bill today so we would give an opportunity for such an amendment to be prepared, and we can bring it back to a work session at a later date. I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2320. And open a public hearing on House Bill 2321. Council Plummer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, House Bill 2321 increases a driver's license suspension to 10 years when it was suspended because the driver failed to appear for a traffic-related court proceeding or failed to pay a fine or obey an order by the courts.
The Click State Court Administrator. This bill is also another collection tool for collecting debt. This does relate to traffic offenses. The bill, in more simple description, seeks to change the suspension period so that it now covers the extended license renewal period. Previously, license suspensions were for 5 years, and that's what the current law still says, but the license renewal period was 4 years. So when you came up for your renewal, they looked, it had a flag, do you still owe, and your license is suspended, and so you pay it, you get your reinstatement, and you get renewed. When they changed it to 8 years, the link wasn't changed to change the suspension period. So this bill would change the suspension period from 5 to 10 years, so that now when you come for your renewal, you're still in suspended status, you would pay your obligation, and then you could get your renewal. Otherwise, you just wait out your 5 years and come in, and you can get your reinstatement without a problem. So that's kind of the simple part. The other thing I did want to mention is that there are a number of ways that a person who has the suspended license can work out agreements to get their license restored. They have the courts enter into payment agreements. There are different license reinstatement programs that they can work out with the Department of Motor Vehicles as well. So this really captures those who are ignoring any type of payment and kind of encourages voluntary compliance, because when you do want to go get your license renewed, it's a good time to take care of any outstanding balances.
Questions for Ms. Click?
Well, I need to understand a little bit better how the license issuance period correlates with the suspension period. That is, I was hearing 4 years for a license had been changed to 8 years, but I needed to understand how the 4 year license issuance period connects to the 5 year suspension under prior law, and therefore the logic of 8 years and 10 years. Because the suspension could arise at any point during the interval between the issuance of a person's license, right?
This Chair McPherson, usually you've gone into court, you owe whatever, you've got your judgment that you owe. Then if you don't pay the financial obligation, or you haven't entered into agreement to pay over time or somehow taking care of it, I mean, that period's running, that original five-year period was running. So when you came in for your renewal, I know what you're saying. I don't know that they may have Cheryl Stone, because she's worked with this closely, come up and explain. But the overlap period pretty well covered most any time your license was suspended. If you're in your 5 years, and say at year three you got your traffic fine, didn't pay, you would have been suspended like 90 days later if you didn't take care of it. So when you're coming in 2 years later, you're still driving under a suspended license, hoping you're not caught in the meanwhile. It would still flag you, because even though 3 years in, then it would, that 5 year would have extended out. But if you're getting renewed on an 8 year and you got it at 3 years, then you come in and you potentially can get, after that 5 year expiration, you could, nothing would be showing up on your record. So I'm making it more complicated.
No,
I think
I understand the point, though. The point is, you want a longer suspension period than the interval between licenses, so that there will always be a license renewal that is during a period when you're subject to suspension. That's
Chair McPherson, yes. And the civil judgment period is 10 years, and so that correlates with what a normal judgment would run.
Okay. Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Click, I have a question that may be answered in your written testimony, but I just want to make sure I understand this. During that 10-year period of suspension, if then the driver says, well, I had a really bad couple of years and now I want to pay this, then they can go in and pay and then go through a reinstatement process. Is that correct?
Chair McPherson, Representative Bonamici, yes.
Thank you.
That's great.
Any other questions?
Thank you, Ms. Click. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2321, and I'll open a work session on House Bill 2321. I think I understand the purpose, which is simply to make sure that there is a license renewal that falls before during the period of suspension. So there's an extra sort of motivation for people to settle up their fines. So I would entertain a motion for this, and I would say that this probably takes some explanation on the floor. I think this is probably not suitable for a consent calendar. Is there a motion?
Chair.
Chair McPherson, I move that we do a do-pass motion for moving House Bill 2321 to the floor.
Representative Comp has moved House Bill 2321 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? If not, let the call roll.
Representative Bonamici?
Aye.
Representative Cameron?
Excuse.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative Kopp?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Reed?
Aye.
Vice Chair Barker?
Aye.
Vice Chair Whitman?
Aye.
Chair McPherson?
Aye. And Representative Kopp, since you stepped forward to move that bill, would you be willing to carry that on the floor?
I will be glad to, so long as counsel helps me write the testimony.
Okay. I'm sure that you'll find that Counsel Plummer is quite expert. And
thank you.
Will assist you. I will close the work session on House Bill 2321 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2322. Counsel Taylor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2322 comes to you from the Judicial Department, and it is their housekeeping bill. I believe Jim Nass is here to testify on the bill. It allows an affidavit in support of a search warrant to be sworn over the telephone. It has other procedures relating to the affidavit. It sets forth the time period for filing of amended notice of appeal or corrected a supplemental criminal judgment, clarifies the prohibition against judges practicing law applies only to judges with full-time positions and not to part-time pro tem judges, clarifies an automatic stay of judgment and appeal requires the filing of a notice of appeal and not just the filing of a supersedious bond with the trial court. A supersedious bond is a bond that's filed in appeal and to ensure that the moving party, the appellant, can pay the judgment if they lose. Authorizes the prevailing party in appeal to recover the cost of copying the trial court record, allows the Chief Justice to set certification copy fees for appellate and administrative records and services, gives the Chief Justice of the Oregon Supreme Court the authority to allow a circuit court to meet in a location other than the county seat in emergency, clarifies the process for consolidating juvenile dependency and domestic cases into a single circuit court.
We have a single witness, Ms. Click. Were you hoping to avoid having to recap all of that by stepping away? And Jim Nass, I guess, is not signed up, but apparently ready to come forward.
I'm just assisting.
For the record, Kingsley Click, State Court Administrator, and with me is Jim Nass, appellate staff attorney for our Court of Appeals and Supreme Court. And since half this bill involves some of the issues from the appellate courts, it's probably appropriate that I had him in the background as we needed. So it's appropriate to have him up here. Thank you for pre-session filing this bill on behalf of the Judicial Department. As I think we explained at Interim Judiciary for those that were there, that each session we do have a internal process for technical changes, administrative housekeeping changes that the judges and the court clerks and others have identified as needing correction. We always kind of look at them, as you know, to change something is sometimes the cure is worse than the problem, but these have been identified as ones that are more problematic and worth the attempt to cure them. We put them together in a single bill just to hopefully prevent the problem of having lots of individual bills on minor issues for you to consider. So this bill has 8 different areas that it's focused on, though I hope from our explanation they are reasonably straightforward, even if some of them are somewhat esoteric. The first one is to streamline the process to obtain a search warrant by telephone process. This was from Judge Michael Marcus, but we also vetted it with our Judicial Conference Criminal Law Committee judges and with the Chief Justice's Criminal Law Advisory Committee, which is composed of the district attorneys, criminal defense bar, and others in the criminal justice system. What it is aimed at doing is trying to find an improved way around issuing search warrants over the phone, especially in the middle of the night, when right now there's a requirement for a notarized affidavit. That creates a number of issues with having to find a notary on an emergency basis at night. It also has a number of requirements to try and scan and transmit this notarized document to the judge for consideration. For a long time, there's been additional ways to in-person review of search warrants and telephonic and fax or email. What this does is just takes care of the notarization requirement by substituting it with an oath there is an oath requirement, but lets the oath also be documented by the person's swearing over the phone with the judge, them signing there, and the judge also notating in a declaration that the judge signs when and how the judge administered the oath to the officer or the person taking out the application. So that is Section 1. Section 2 and 3 is to correct the notice of appeal filing. Jim Nass will be able to give you letter and verse on how this causes problems. But basically, right now, after you have your regular judgment, you send up your notice of appeal, the defendant or most often the defendant's counsel. There is four motions that happen after the fact, some error, something that occurs after the original judgment. There's a need for an amended or supplemental judgment. Under the statute, there's no requirement that the trial court provide this to the defendant, and so often there is an amended judgment that's gone up. The defendant's appeal is progressing. No one knows that now they must file an amended notice of appeal. So this would put it really in the appellate court's responsibility to provide the notice to the defendant and allows them to have the 30 days to send up an amended notice after that. We knew, as many of you were able to hear, we have a new appellate case management system at the appellate level. A new trial court one is many years still away. But it can automatically generate notices to parties. So we don't think this will, we think this will actually decrease delay instead of increase problems in this area. So that is a request for that section. The part-time judicial service, as counsel pointed out, there are some anachronisms in the statute that have created some problems when dealing with pro tems and part-time and volunteer judges about the practice of law. This just is an attempt to restate that section so that it covers what it did before, but in the method intended, which is that if you're a regularly elected circuit judge, etc., full-time judge, then you don't practice law. But if you're a pro tem and you come in and for the period that you're serving as a judge, you can't practice, but otherwise you can. Now there are the code and other parts of statute that talk about, you know, you can't have conflicts of interest and you can't, you know, do it in this county and things like that. So this just tries to clarify that, and also that the authorized by law to be a practicing attorney is that you be an active member of the Oregon State Bar. Section 5, automatic stays of judgment. Counsel, I think, went over this fully, but it's just to clarify in the statute that in order to stop, hold the execution of the judgment, that not only do you have to file this supersedious bond with the court, but you also have to file your notice of appeal. For whatever reason, some litigants have thought if they just filed the bond, then that automatically would stay the judgment, and that's not the case under case law. Excerpt of record, this is just to conform the statute now with what the Oregon Rules of Appellate Procedure provide and is less of a burden on the litigants cost-wise as well as creates less confusion with the Court of Appeals staff. I have more questions. Conforming administrative authority, this is Section 7 with the appellate courts. Right now, the Chief Justice, by order, sets all the miscellaneous fees for the trial courts. Since the early 1900s, there have been a few statutory fees that were set by statute for the appellate courts and administration that were not similarly set for the trial courts. There's been a lot of interest in having more uniform fee schedules for automation, and so the request here is to acknowledge the Chief Justice's authority to similarly set these miscellaneous fees in the appellate courts as well, and these are published fee schedules. Then in the emergency designations, certainly the Marion County issue and Katrina and other recent disasters have brought home for all of state government and governments that you need to have some emergency authority at certain times of crisis. We use the definition of emergency that's in the statute for the governor and others declaring an emergency, and in those situations, this would allow the Chief Justice to designate an out-of-district location for a court to sit. Consolidation of cases clarification. This one, for whatever reasons, I think, well, for good reasons, judges who know how to consolidate a juvenile case and a domestic relations case in family court when there are within a single judicial district are comfortable doing that. But they noted that the statute doesn't give them the same express authority that it does to consolidate those cases when there are circuit courts within the same judicial district but have more than one county. So the request was that we add that missing piece to say that no matter where your circuit court is located, you can follow the same procedures to consolidate your two cases in family court. And then the rest are basically unit captions, conforming language. It does have an emergency clause. It's not a major issue for us. It just, by having an emergency clause, it would allow these things to take effect as soon as it passed and was signed.
Okay.
Then passing a ban on us having housekeeping bills. What would you like to ask?
Well, I don't expect there will be a protracted debate either in committee or on the floor on this bill. Any questions?
Representative Bonamici. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Ms. Click, for your testimony. And the section 4, the second clause, where a judicial officer appointed or elected to a full-time position may not have a partner who acts as an attorney in the court in which the judicial officer presides. Is that intended to say they just resign from their law practice so that their law partners, they can't maintain their partnership in their law firm? I'm just trying to figure out what that the intent of that is.
Chairman Pearson, Representative Bonamici. My understanding was that picked up the current statute, and what I at least know the current practice is if you could not be on a case in which your law partner appeared in front of you. And generally that's how it's been interpreted in the past.
Jim, are you, do you have any further experience
with
that?
My name is Jim Nass. I don't have any experience with this. I notice, as Kingsley mentioned, that this tracks, if you look at the wording being deleted on page 4, lines 6 and 7, I think was an attempt by the Legislative Council to track that wording.
Without change.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair. The thing that I question is whether that, if the now judge resigns from his or her law firm, then they're no longer a partner.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
So, does this mean former partner as well as existing partner?
Chair McPherson, Representative Bonamici, this, I see what you're saying, and that is the past language, and it really meant to track like the pro tem situations, but this does bring it up in the other. So they would not any longer certainly have a partner, but and there are conflicts that would be declared about a partner appearing in front, but you're right, they would not be a partner anymore. So
that's an interesting point.
As I understand what you're saying, is the way it was redrafted, it gives it a different meaning that's not is somewhat nonsensical.
But what is there, maybe I'm just not seeing it here, is there a separate provision that says that they have to, they're in a full-time position, they have to resign from a law practice partnership?
Mm-hmm. Chair McPherson, they may not practice law, so I guess in that sense that covers that area. I don't know if there's anything other than the disciplinary rules that would and judicial canons that cover that you can't have a practice otherwise.
Representative Flores.
Thank you. Ms. Glick, is there ever a situation that we might be aware of wherein a person who is a judicial officer who may have been elected to a full-time position would retain an of counsel designation with a firm? Or is that considered improper?
Chair McPherson, Representative Flores, a judge could not, a fully elected or appointed circuit judge or could not retain another counsel designation. We do have senior judges who have retired from the bench who may have some of counsel designation but cannot do that during any time they would be appointed to serve as a pro tem judge.
Council Taylor.
Chair, members of the committee, just my thought on this, reading the language in its context, it would imply that this is a legal partnership, but reading in the language itself, may not have a partner is not limited to legal practice. It may very well be talking about a situation with a partnership in a real estate venture or something.
Mm-hmm. Representative Wisnett.
Could be partnership in marriage. We had a situation in my county where there was a lady running for judge and her husband was district attorney. You're trying to eliminate conflicts of interest. Mm-hmm.
I'd say that now that we start probing that language, Ms. Clegg, there you know, several questions are coming out about it, and I do think Council Taylor's question raises a good point that just applying that to the practice setting I'm most familiar with, in addition to our law partnership, there are, I think, various investment partnerships or joint ventures or what have you among individual members of the firm. And if one of those went on the bench, then literally this would be saying that they couldn't continue in that investment partnership, which might have nothing to do with the practice of law, and that would seem it's probably overly broad. That is, that they would they should have to business relationships with somebody who's an advocate before the court, before the court they're presiding in would probably cause them to have to recuse themselves. But that's a separate issue, I think, than saying that they can't be a partner.
Chairman McPherson, it does say may not have a partner who acts as an attorney in the court. So in that sense, that your situation might arise, it sounds like it may be more in context of what Counsel Taylor has brought up and Representative Wisnant, where you would have a spouse, another person, sister, brother, in that situation instead. Certainly in your situation, there would be a conflict of interest and the judge would be required to recuse him or herself.
Do you have in mind things that could be done to the language of Section 4 to address the issues that have been raised here? Have we given you sufficient guidance that you could bring forward amendments that would fix the concerns?
Chair McPherson, I think working with Counsel Taylor, we could make it more clear.
Okay.
Chairman, as a committee, I think it would help to get some guidance on this. My assumption is that you would not want a member of the bench practicing law unless it was a matter that directly involved the individual in the sense of the same an individual would have a right to go and represent themselves. Is that correct?
My concern, thank you, Mr. Chair, my concern is, say, for example, a lawyer is appointed to the bench or is elected to the bench from private practice, leaves his or her law firm, and resigns from that firm, is no longer a partner in the firm, and then the next day one of the former partners comes into the courtroom to try a case and says, I'm not a partner anymore. Is that the kind of situation that this is intended to prohibit or not? I don't know. And maybe that judge would recuse him or herself under the Code of Judicial Conduct, but I don't, according to this, I don't know if this language addresses that situation.
Now, Chair, members of the committee, maybe the best thing is to figure out what this committee would want to do if the language were to be changed. And Ms. Click can address this better than I can, which you may have in some jurisdictions, for example, an enterprise, Joseph. Someone's appointed to the bench. It may be difficult if they could not have their partner appear before, former partner appear before them, because it may be difficult to get judges out there. I'm not sure how that's handled, but I take it at least the sense from this committee is that you would say a person appointed to the bench should not be practicing law, and then B, the issue would be what about former partners? Is that?
It seems to me we don't need to deal with that by statute. I mean, we have a code of judicial conduct, and we have standards on by which judges are recuse themselves if they have any one of a range of different relationships with the people who are coming before the court. And I don't think we need to put those in statute. And the starting point for this, I think, was that there was at least an unclarity in the law about the status of pro tem judges, mm-hmm. who in fact are judges who have an active practice. And so obviously it doesn't make sense to be bringing in pro tem judges to hear cases and then preclude them from engaging in practice. So that's the issue that was aimed to be fixed. And we should fix that and probably not do anything particularly more than that. I mean, I don't think we need to say by statute, you know, when a judge can sit or not.
There's not that much paper to write that one.
other than to say that if you have a regular, if you're elected or appointed to a regular judgeship, then you should not be engaged in the active practice of law. I mean, those are two separate paths, and you have chosen by accepting the appointment or seeking an election, you've chosen to go on the bench, and then you personally shouldn't have an active practice of law at that point, as distinguished from a pro tem who is appointed to hear particular cases and who maintains an active practice. And beyond that distinction, I don't think we need to say more. Is that sufficient guidance?
Mr. Chair, I had one other thought looking at the language that's being deleted. It refers to county court judges for those few counties in eastern Oregon that still have a county court, and justices of the peace, which are not always full-time judgeships. So I'm thinking this language maybe was originally intended to apply to those part-timers, but would equally be applicable to anybody serving as a pro tem judge. I think you're hitting on it.
Right. So they would just expand that category I was describing. The pro tem and municipal or justice court judges would clarify that they are permitted to have an active practice, but those judges who accept a election or appointment to the circuit court bench as a regular sitting judge could not have an active practice.
And the follow-up piece is that if a county judge, justice of the peace, or pro tem judge is serving as a judge, they cannot have a law partner appearing in front of them. I think is what subsection 2 is. I think the last the wording at line 6 and 7, I think, was originally intended to apply to those part-time judges, that there was intended to be a ban on those judges who in their private practice had partners appearing in front of them now as judge. At least I'm throwing that out.
Representative Barker.
You run into those kind of conflicts, and I think the judges deal with those. I mean, I can think of cases where deputy district attorneys are appointed judge, and then their co-workers are appearing before them as prosecutors. And I mean, judges, I think in the judicial community, that's a pretty small community, and so they're going to have a wife of a judge is appearing before another judge who's, of course, their social friends and everything. And I think the judges know, you know, the boundaries there and separate them. I don't know how we can write that, is what I'm saying there. I mean, I don't like to use the term interbred, but it's kind of an interbred community. And so you're going to have people appearing who know each other in those courts.
Right. So, yeah. And I don't think we need to say by statute there's a whole body of rules and ethics that can govern how our judges behave. And all we want to do by statute is to say that the full-time regular judges cannot themselves continue to practice before that court, and as distinguished from the clarification we're trying to accomplish, which is the pro tems, the county court, and justice court judges can. Okay.
Chairman McPherson,
I think the point of the clarification that Representative Bonamici was trying to get to, which was the partnership practicing before that elected.
I think where we're headed was that we wouldn't try to address that point because it doesn't need to be spoken to here in statute.
And I agree.
And Mr. Chair, I think what you're talking about is addressed in sentence one, if I'm not mistaken.
I think it is. So it may be just shortening this section 4. Council Taylor.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I assume, too, that a full-time judge cannot be involved in a partnership practicing law either.
Council, I think we'd have to then go to an analysis of what the nature of the partnership is, because some partnerships have more diverse kinds of functions. And again, I think the recusal process and the rules of judicial ethics are probably sufficient to govern that, rather than trying to say, I mean, if we've said you can't be practicing law either individually or as a member of a partnership,
okay.
I think that kind of cuts across it. Any more questions or comments?
Mr. Chair?
I think then Mr. Nass, if you have anything to close here, we'll...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to make clear that under current law is no judicial officer shall have a partner who shall practice law or act as attorney in the court over which the judicial officer presides. That's current law. If you want to take out, in essence, subsection 2 of the new language, the wording at lines 10 and 11, that's a policy choice for you to make. But I think it is changing current law a little bit. We bring these housekeeping bills forward, kind of our intent is just to carry forward current law because we assume that's what you want. But if you want to change the policy, he's certainly entitled to do that.
Council Tanner. Chairman, as a committee, I hate to belabor the point, but Mr. Nass, does that mean if a judge is sitting in Multnomah County, they can have a partner that practices in Washington County? A law partner?
Mr. Chair, I think what the current wording speaks to is the justice of the peace or the county court judge who does that on a part-time basis, and for the rest of their professional lives, they're in a law firm. Let's say I'm in the law firm of Nass and Nass, and also turns out that I'm the justice of the peace for a court in my county. When I'm sitting on the bench as a justice of the peace, is it okay for my brother and partner to appear in front of me as a lawyer for one of the parties? Current law seems to indicate no, you can't do that. All I want to make clear is that if you want to change that, since we are proposing to delete that wording at line 6 and 7, if we also take out the new subsection 2, we'll have removed that ban.
Yeah, and Mr. Nass, I understand that we're focusing on some language that I think is overly broad in current law. That's because what does it mean to be a partner of? I mean, for one thing, a lot of firms are not constituted as partnerships any longer. They're constituted as professional corporations. So are we trying to draw a distinction between a partnership for the practice of law and a professional corporation that engages in the practice? I just think it's antiquated language. As long as we're cleaning this up, we ought to clean it up.
Chair McPherson, and we'll work with Council to make it just simple on what needs to be said for that circumstance and let the rest of the, because we did bring it because it was archaic language and anachronistic in many ways. So if the policies clean that out, we will do that.
Okay. I think we probably.
Mike, thank you. I would still like it to be clear that we would not like to condone a partner or for to be practicing before a presiding officer. And I'm not comfortable with eliminating that or setting that forward as something that needs to be paid attention to.
Then what we should do is involve you and the Representative Flores in the ongoing tinkering of this language so we make sure that it addresses your concern. But I would suggest that the language that focuses on a partner status is out-of-date language, and we need to get that concept.
And Mr. Chair, is Representative Flores' concern something that's covered in the Code of Judicial Conduct? That I don't know.
Well, I think it is, although I'm certain no expert on that, okay, that source at all.
Chair McPherson, I'd be happy to work with the amendments in the and then
if you could make sure that you've
Florence
consulted with the committee members who've taken an interest in this bill, to just make sure we're
before we have amendments drafted, like to make sure everybody was okay.
Council Chair, members of the committee, I would be glad to sit down, Mr. Nass and Ms. Click, and with Dave Hendricks, the Legislative Council's office, and as long as we don't have a quorum, any of the members who have an interest in this issue in my office, and we can kind of hash the language out in the policy. That's okay.
Very good. Committee members, thank you for your input. I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2322. That concludes our agenda. We are adjourned.